I am Bill Hurd, the present chair of Elders for Justice. In June of 88, I believe it was 16 of us met in Cabrini Center in one of the suburbs of Chicago to decide if indeed there was reason or reasons for a group as known as Elders for Justice to exist, and we decided that there was. We set up ourselves some goals that we'll talk about later. We got started on them. We didn't get as much done as we had hoped to. We strongly feel that there is a need for a group of elders in the church who are concentrate around justice issues. And this evening we're going to get started off with the first chair, Paul Bowe.
We're taping this session, so I have to give my name and what our topic is. My name is Paul Bowe, and our topic tonight is, can we do justice? Before we get into that topic, however, I would like to just say a couple more words in addition to what Bill Hurd has said about Elders for Justice. It came into sort of a preliminary formation several years ago when a number of us met in the Twin Cities and began to talk about what possibilities there are for older people who are concerned for justice issues but no longer are involved directly in some of the processes either of the church or of justice organizations that may be peripheral to the church or as a part of society. And so out of several preliminary meetings under the leadership of Jim Sefkis, I don't see Jim here at the present moment.
Yes.
Oh, there he is, right in the back there, who is on the staff of the ELCA and has been sort of our sponsor and mentor over the last several years. We began to organize, and as Bill said, we got together for the first time in June of 1988. We are now coming into our second year of organization and operation. I see a lot of gray heads here tonight. This is a good time to welcome you all to join Elders for Justice. I see quite a few people who do not have gray hairs tonight. And I also would like to say to them that we have a special membership for people who are under the age of retirement. We call them junior citizens. They can become members of Elders for Justice for a $5 fee. The rest of us older people have to pay $10. But we welcome junior citizen members if they would like to participate in Elders for Justice. Before I begin what I'd like to speak about tonight, I want to tell you how good it is for me to be back here at Holden. Some of you may not know that my wife Carola and I lived here from last September, about this time last September, until the end of June. I was the interim director during the time the board was seeking a new director, and so Carola and I lived up in Chalet 4, up on the hill. And we survived a long winter here at Holden. There were 16 feet of snow during the time we were here. It didn't all stay on the ground all our time, but I'd like to tell you that the pathways that went across back and forth around Holden here, where it's not plowed out, the pathways were never dug out. So we walked on top of the snow, and it packed down and packed down and packed down until it got 5 or 6 feet deep. And you had to be very, very careful, because if you tripped or slipped off the edge of that path, you went into snow up to your waist. We were very mindful of of what some of the staff members said, that a few years ago they had a very, very heavy snowfall during the winter. And I can't tell how deep it was, but it was very deep. And a rather heavy woman, who weighed quite a bit, fell off the pathway, and it took them an hour and a half to get her back up on the pathway. So you can see that being at home for a winter was a rather sad thing. The other thing that happened to Corolla and me was that almost all winter we were at least twice as old as almost anybody else in the village. And so we got used to dealing with young people. And after 5 or 6 months of this, we began to perceive ourselves in that sense. And then in the middle of May, an elder hostel started. And I made a practice during the time I was here of meeting each bus and shaking hands with the people as they got off. And I was used to shaking hands with all these younger people and so on and so on. And all of a sudden, out of this bus came all these gray-headed people. And I looked at them and I shook hands and finally I looked at Crow and I said, "These old people aren't going to be able to make it here." Then I found that Kroll and I were at least 5 or 6 years older than most of the elder hostels. So we had a kind of a youthful perspective after living with the people at Holden here during that year. And it was really a wonderful and a great experience. We found it a rather difficult adjustment to go back to our little rural congregation in northern Wisconsin and to the rural community there after the stimulating and mind-boggling things that we dealt with while we were here at Holden. And it's been just a great experience to come back here again. Well, tonight we're going to talk for a while about the question, can we do justice? And quite a few years ago, when I was with the National Church Body of the American Lutheran Church, I was quite a crusader for issues for justice, particularly justice for minority people, and particularly justice for Indian people. And Kroll and I worked a great deal with Indian people. But over the years since that time, some very troubling questions have come up in my mind and in Corolla's mind, and I think in many minds, about how do you do justice and can we really even do justice in our time? I was reading an article the other day that Jim Seifkus sent out to those of us who are part of the Mission Discovery Program. And in it, it talked about four aspects of the mission of the church. The first being kerygma, which is a Greek word for the proclamation of the word. The second being koinonia. We're gathered in a building here that's called koinonia, which means the community or the fellowship of those who are together in the word of God. And the third aspect of the ministry of the church is diakonia, which is the serving of people. Now, when I was at the seminary, and even up until the 1960s when I went to the national offices, those were the three aspects of the mission of the church. Since that time, since the 1960s, a fourth one has come into our consciousness, which is called justica, which is advocacy for justice. I think we as Christians have to be concerned with all of these aspects of the mission of the church. We have to be involved in all of them. But we also know that God has given to each of his people different kinds of interests and different kinds of talents. The Apostle Paul recognized this when he said some are called to be prophets and some teachers and some administrators and some those who serve and so on. So that even though all of us are interested in and concerned about the total ministry of the church, the proclamation, the fellowship, the service, the advocacy for justice, each of us, I think, have been given certain talents and certain zealousness, you might say, for certain aspects of that ministry. And some of us who have gathered together in this group called Elders for Justice feel that advocacy for justice is probably one of the things that we would like to spend whatever time we have left in furthering the ministry and the witness of God. I came to the national offices of the American Lutheran Church in 1961. At that time, we barely ever heard of advocacy for justice. Probably the best we ever did in the church at that time was to have an office that wrote position papers on certain issues of justice. But we never really called on our people to be an advocate for justice. We called on our people to digest these position papers in kind of an intellectual way, but we never did really push for advocacy. My office, the Office of Social Services, really was not an advocacy office. We were an office of serving the needs of people. We worked with old people. We worked with children. We worked with troubled families. We did adoptions. We did family counseling and this kind of thing. But the issue of the church's role in doing justice never became a very important part of the church. Most of us here tonight, and I look at all of the gray hairs around here tonight, most of us here tonight are very, very conscious of what happened to our country and to our church during the 1960s and the early 1970s. The social turmoil that began to take place in the 1960s, the people who began to speak up about the problems that they faced in life. That women began to speak out about injustices to women. Racial minorities, blacks and Indians and Hispanics, began to speak out about how they had been excluded from the goods and the good of society. Young people began to speak about how they had been excluded from the decision-making process that involved them in such things as the Vietnamese War and things like this. That turmoil that took place in our country faced the church with some very difficult and troubling questions. We were faced with the questions of, can we be an advocate as a church for women? Can we be an advocate for blacks and Indians and Hispanics? Can we be an advocate for young people? Can we be advocates for all of those who in some way or another have been hurt by the attitudes and the laws and the customs that we have had in our country? This has always been a great strain for the church to try to deal with the question of how do you be and become an advocate for justice. Fact of the matter is, I don't think the church has even been able to define justice. What is justice? Last year, when we had our first meeting of our Elders for Justice in Chicago, our keynote speaker was Dr. Nelson Trout. Many of you know him, a very eloquent man. And he started out by saying, the church has got to begin to develop a theology of justice, so that we may begin to deal in a cognizant way with the issues of justice. Not only have we not been able to define what justice is, we haven't been able to define who defines what justice is. Who is the subject of the justice acts that we might take? Who makes judgments on what is just and what is unjust? Even today, as we heard in the sermon tonight, the church is divided over justice issues. For instance, the Board of Pensions. Many of us, some of us who have been pastors in the church or lay workers in the church, are now the recipients of a pension plan of the church. But the pension system of the church right now is dividing the church. People are angry and are divided over the question of whether we should invest the funds of the pension plan of the church to make the most income, or shall we invest those funds to deal with justice issues, such as in South Africa and other places in the world. And each of those points of view has its advocates within the church. So that even today, we cannot even make up our minds about the justice use of pension funds of the church. The church has all kinds of people. Who do we speak for in the church? I remember when Carola and I were out on the road a great deal speaking on behalf of Indian people and speaking about the treaties and all of that kind of thing. And we were speaking strongly about the need of the church to back Indian people as they sought for their rights under the treaties and as they sought for their rights as a racial minority. And always, whenever we spoke in the congregation or in the church group, and then we had a discussion afterwards, somebody would speak up and say, "Well, you can have your point of view, but you don't speak for me." And so the question is raised, what is justice? How do we deal with justice? Right now in northern Wisconsin, where Carola and I come from, we are embroiled in a very, very difficult decision-making process over the ancient treaties under which the several thousands of Indians that are in northern Wisconsin govern themselves under the treaty system of the United States government. Northern Wisconsin is split over that issue. Not only northern Wisconsin is split over the issue, but the Lutheran churches are split over the issue. There are Lutheran people in our congregations in northern Wisconsin, some very prominent Lutheran people, which belong to a group called PARR, P-A-R-R, which is Protect Our Rights and Resources. It's an anti-Indian group. And just as strong, on the other hand, are Lutherans who advocate the rights of Indians, who call upon the church people to support the treaties and the rights of Indians under those treaties. So we have the question, who does the church speak for when it speaks for justice? How shall we in the church act today when we are confronted with such a bewildering array of issues? Mrs. Solberg, Helen Solberg, is going to be presenting something on Namibia during our sessions during the next several days. We are being called upon to support the Namibian people in their struggle against the government of South Africa. It becomes a very divisive issue for the church. How do we deal with that? How do we deal with the question of abortion? Who has rights over life? A pregnant woman or the fetus that is within her? Where is the justice in the church's point of view on abortion? The ugly head of racism is raising its ugly head again. And I just read in the paper where groups of people are calling into question some of the acts of our government in favoring minorities so that they may catch up. And now white people are saying that they are being discriminated against as we attempt to help minority people achieve justice in our country. And so we are confronted by these and literally dozens of other issues that are confronting us and asking us to make decisions about justice. The very concept of justice itself seems to be in question. Even God seems limited in advocating for justice. When Carol and I were here at Holden this winter, we had a study of a book on Job by Garatez. And it became very evident as we studied the book of Job that God in many ways was not acting justly. He put Job in the hands of Satan. He allowed Satan to torture him. He allowed Satan to kill off his children, destroy his property. And God and Satan engaged in a sort of conversation about this. God didn't even seem to be very upset about what was happening. And we don't get a picture of God in the Old Testament particularly as being a just God. We heard something about that in the Old Testament text tonight, where God is talking about how his people of Israel failed him and went off after Baal and other gods and so on. And at one point, you remember in the life of Moses, God said, "Get out of the way, Moses, so I can let my wrath wax hot against these stiff-necked people." And Moses had to argue with God to argue him out of exercising judgment and punishment upon those people. God doesn't always punish the evil. We know that. God sometimes almost seems to reward evil people. And the Apostle Paul said that God makes his rain to fall both on the just and on the unjust. Even today, it's difficult to make out a real theologically sound case that God acts justly, at least justly in the context of our concept of justice. And it's difficult to even use God as an illustration of justice. I find myself quite frequently on shaky ground when I'm dealing with justice issues, and I often have to make up my mind as to how I feel about them. Carl and I ate lunch the other day in Minneapolis at the St. Martin's Table. Some of you have been at that restaurant, which is operated by Mrs. Schramm, who used to be here at Holden Village. And I picked up a book on justice, and I paged it through, and I found that it was a dissertation on six different Christian concepts of justice. And again, I found myself extremely confused. So I say to you, as we come together this week here at Holden as elders for justice, I think we have a great deal to do to help ourselves to think about what is justice. What are we elders who are talking about it about as we contemplate the issues of justice? Now let me take a little different tack and another kind of word. I guess over the years, I have become more and more concerned about a different word than justice. And that word is compassion. I believe that as we look upon the ills of society, as we look upon those who are suffering, as we look upon those who have been excluded from the things that are good in society and the things that God would have for people, that we need to exercise, as much as we need to exercise justice, we need to exercise compassion. Compassion, I believe, is the basic Christian expression. If you listen carefully to that Old Testament lesson that was read tonight from the altar, and then was read again by the preacher, you remember that God detailed how his people had strayed away from him and how they deserved punishment. But then he said, "But I will have compassion on them. I will withhold my wrath from these people, even though they have strayed away." And I think what characterizes God more than his aspect of justice is the characteristic of compassion. I think that characterizes God from the very beginning. God has always acted toward his people with compassion, not always, I believe, with justice. And I think that you and I know, as we have come to know God throughout our lives, if you and I review our own experience of God, we know that compassion is the basic feature of our Christian experience. As we began our Eucharist tonight, we turned to the back cover of the hymnal, and in there was a confession of sins. And we confessed together our sins. And then the pastor read those wonderful words of forgiveness and renewal. And that's part of the compassion of God. And I think that's at the basis of God's relationship with people. Liberation theology, in itself a rather controversial thing. The liberation theologians claim that God tilts toward the poor. And he tilts toward the poor not because he is just, but because he has compassion on them. Because they are weak, because they are under the thumb of those who are stronger than they are, and because, as a result, their lives are less than what God would have for them. And that equals compassion. And liberation theologians are calling upon us to exercise compassion, particularly to those who are poor and those who are deprived. The other thing about compassion that I think is very important is that compassion does not rest on a judgment about who deserves something. I remember when Carl and I were out on the road speaking a great deal about Indian concerns, almost always somebody in the discussion period would raise the questions, aren't Indians lazy? Aren't Indians drunks? Don't Indians think differently than we do about the world? Don't they have a different kind of value system than we have? How can you say they deserve something from us? The compassion of God and the compassion of Jesus Christ does not rest on what we deserve. The judgment about exercising compassion never rests on how much you and I deserve it. If that were the case, most of us would not be coming to the Lord's Supper. We would not be coming to God's house because we don't deserve that fellowship with God. God doesn't ask who is good enough. God asks what the need is. And that's where God's compassion is exercised. Compassion looks at needs. It looks at conditions. It looks at the factors that create suffering and create separateness among people. And so I believe that the gospel calls us to compassion. And so, as we are here as elders for justice, we're going to consider some of these issues and how we can be advocates as elders, not only for justice in the world, which frequently is a divisive thing, but how we can be advocates for compassion. And how that compassion can outcome in changes in laws, changes in attitudes, changes in customs, changes in the way we deal with the issues in the world, changes in our attitudes toward those who are excluded. This is what I think we as elders for justice ought to be thinking about, and this is what I think we are called upon to do And if we can find ways of motivating and strengthening our people and reaching out in compassion within the framework, of course, of justice, and I'm not putting that down, but I think that compassion is something that we can understand and deal with in a much more effective way. Well, there's much more to be said, and a lot more to be said about the work of Elders for Justice. And I want to end again with inviting any of you that would like to join with us in this kind of a quest and in this kind of an expression of our Christian faith to talk to Lois over here, who is our secretary. She'll give you the means to do that, and she'll collect your $10 or your $5 if you want to join.